The particular text that we will be looking at this morning and is sort of exemplary for a lot of the discussions this week is the account of the stilling of the storm. Now, this is recorded in Matthew and Mark and Luke. Which of them should we read first? You are just sitting there so pure-hearted and empty-minded. Because the moment you answered that question, you would be betraying a presupposition. No. Let me confess my presupposition, which is shared in general by sort of the scholars of the day. And that is that we would first read Mark, because it is generally supposed, that the Mark is the oldest account. You observe that I did not say it is the oldest account, that because there's a good argument for letting Matthew be the oldest one. But the preponderance of the evidence, more of the data fits if one works with Mark as the oldest gospel. The key to that view is the fact that Matthew and Luke follow the sequence of Mark, and whenever they vary or differ from Mark in their sequence, they differ from one another. Lachman was the great scholar who formulated that as the thread of Ariadne through the whole, what's called the synoptic problem. The three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are the synoptic ones because they tell of the life of Jesus from the same viewpoint, sin with optic eyes. The eyes are together on the life of Jesus from a similar viewpoint, and the contrast with that is the Gospel according to St. John that has another way of telling of Jesus' life and ministry. And we don't have to bother about John because he doesn't tell us about the stilling of the storm. So there are some good grounds, but they are already presuppositions we are bringing to the text when we first read the account in Mark 4:35. But now, if while I am reading Mark, you would be following it in Luke, you will then be able to spot what things are unique, peculiar to the Markan account and the Lucan account. And it is those things which are unique to a particular account which are most significant as clues for what that particular account is driving at. Are you then, would you all gather into Luke 8:22-25. Does anybody lack a Bible? That would be a desperate situation. And then, if you'll use, that's okay, if it's any more needed, there are some over there. You might like to get your three fingers into the Bible. The number three is a good one, but if we pursue the significance of numbers, we will end up with Hal Lindsey having the Chinese charge into Mesopotamia to bring about the interlude for the prelude for the end of the world. And besides, there aren't any numbers here particularly to bother about. So, just three meanings three fingers without meaning, only having a usefulness. What is the use? And that usefulness question is one which we will bring to each of these three accounts. To what purpose, for what use, is the account being told in Luke, in Mark, and in Matthew? The Matthew passage is Matthew 8:18. And when your fingers get tired, or you learn that this is really a great way of getting at the study of the Gospels, then you will certainly want to get for yourself what's called the Gospel Parallels by Throckmorton. And there, you see, you've got the three accounts side by side, and your fingers are relieved of flipping back and forth all the time. And there's also one put out by Nelson's called Gospel Parallels as well. Both of these I shall put on the table in the library there where it says Summer Faculty Books for Discussion. So these two, it's not really a Gospel Harmony, but Gospel Parallels. But having only one, if you can bring along three Bibles, then that would solve the need just as well. But these will be there for you in the library. And for this kind of very careful study of the text, you really need a translation, not a paraphrase. And hence, we will be working with the Revised Standard Version. That is a most carefully done translation. You have also the Jerusalem Bible, which is done with great scholarly care and a sense of language, which tends sometimes to be a little eccentric and sometimes a bit too clever. The New English Bible is again a very careful translation with an even greater care for language. But it's a bit too frightfully English. And what inhibited that enterprise was their resolve at the outset not to translate anything as it had been translated in the Authorized Version, the King James Version. Now that is a very sectarian attitude. We're not going to translate it the way it's been translated before. But New English Bible, Jerusalem Bible, but I would recommend for very careful Bible study the RSV. The Authorized Version was the most awfully careful one. You notice there in the King James Version there's the words in italics now and then. They aren't to be emphasized, quite the contrary. They are the words that weren't in the Greek or the Hebrew, but that had to be put in to make an English sentence. But when they put something in, they let you know that they had put it in, and so put it in italics. In contrast with that, you then have also paraphrases, which are not that careful scholarly translation work. And there you might think of Phillips, which reads very beautifully and has for many a rich use in devotions. Particularly the epistles read far more easily and meaningfully in Phillips than they do in the Authorized Version. But he acknowledges that it's not a translation, but a paraphrase. And so he's freer in the way he puts things. And you aren't always aware of where he's pushing it beyond the warrant of the text or not striking to the full size of what the original text says. And that's true also of the Living Bible, which you will observe calls itself a paraphrase. If you want to do solid Bible study, you do it with a translation, not a paraphrase.
Well, now, are we located?
You in Luke 8, 22 to 25, and I shall read Mark 4, 35 to 41. And you've got your other finger in at Matthew 8, 18. Mark. On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd, they took him with them, just as he was, in the boat. And other boats were with him. And a great storm of wind arose, and the waves beat into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care if we perish?" And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. Now, what have you spotted?
Mark has evening.
And what's the value of saying that?
I don't know.
Pardon? Exactly. A storm in the dark is more frightening than a storm in the daytime. And there you have evidence of the way Mark tells things. There is the vivid detail. Mark is the most dramatic writer of the evangelist. He puts things with an urgency and immediacy. You are right there. There's a kind of almost breathless momentum about the way Mark tells the story of Jesus. One of his favorite words is immediately. Everything's always happening immediately in Mark. Whereas Luke is more, of a gentleman. He's better educated, and he doesn't get so excited about things. It's a calmer, more reflected account of the matter. So in Luke doesn't think to put in the dramatic item of the darkness when the storm is going on. Just one day he got into the boat. Now, who got into the boat first?
He went in with
his disciples. That's right. That's how it is in Luke.
Mark has other books too, and I wonder if anybody else witnessed this besides the disciples.
Good.
Mark starts out, that was pretty good. The other boats, did they all decide to go in a group because they were having to go across at night?
Yeah.
There they are. Before Mark tells.
I should say night, I think evening. I don't think it's dark.
You know, it's not dark yet. Well, it's getting dark when they set out, sundown, and so there's not much light left. There again, you've got a vivid detail. Mark, there were other boats. What's the point of his telling us about the other boats? Keep that question for later on. At the moment, I don't think we've got any evidence with our, you know, if your hearts and minds, for getting, we have to pick up clues from somewhere else if we're going to have any idea of what these other boats, or why they happen to be mentioned. So, let us go across to the other side. That's all that and all that Mark says. Of the lake, says Luke. Luke is writing for this Theophilus man, who is a well-educated
Greek or Hellenist, and also not presumably then so closely acquainted with the geography of the place, but it doesn't serve Mark's purpose, so he doesn't mention it as a lake. It's a bit redundant anyhow. And leaving the crowd, what crowd's that? In Mark, there's a talk about the crowd, and that's the crowd.
Well, his mother and brethren had come to look for him.
Where are you? In Luke?
Luke 21.
8:21. Good. And what's the question involved in the in that passage, Luke 8:19-21? Jesus says, who are his mother and his brothers? Who's his family? Who's his people? Who belongs with him? That is there in Luke.
Those who hear the word of God and do it. Those
right.
Are my brothers.
Good. And if you go back to verse 4, you have a great crowd whom Jesus taught, and there the big piece of teaching is the parable of the sower. Now if we look at Mark, we see that you have teaching going on prior to this as well, and at the beginning of chapter 4 in Mark, again he began to teach beside the sea, and a very large crowd gathered about him, so that he got into a boat and sat in it on the sea. So he's in a boat. And in Mark, you see, it then says, they took him as he was. Leaving the crowd, they took him with them, just as he was, in the boat. You know, he didn't have to nip off to the shore for any reason or other, or to get some snacks for the journey. So, and who does the leaving action there? In Mark 8:36. They take Jesus with them, just as he was in the boat. So the departing action is done by the disciples in Mark. In Luke, Jesus says to them, let us go across to the other side of the lake. So they set out. Luke's account is more sort of dull, calm, matter of fact. And as they sailed, he fell asleep. Well, Mark has told us that there were other boats. And Jesus doesn't get to sleep. We aren't told about Jesus sleeping in Mark until there's the great wind and storm going on. Mark 4:37, a great storm of wind arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that the boat was already filling. Now where's Jesus? Lost him. Mark tells us early on that he's gone to sleep in the boat. But Mark carries his account right. Pardon?
He was in the stern.
In the stern.
Asleep on a cushion.
On a cushion! Now what's the point of the cushion? Why does Mark tell us about this cushion? Luke doesn't bother to tell us about the cushion.
Comfortable.
There he is, fast asleep, tucked up, cozy. And here's this whole boat's about to sink.
He's a very wise traveler.
Yes, but the disciples don't think too much of it. Luke tells them that he's got asleep, and then when they're about to go down and it's all up with them, where's Jesus? I sleep, and not and sort of that extra detail on a cushion. What does he care about us? Here we are about to sink. And what is Mark? And so they woke him and said to him, teacher, do you not care if we perish? It's a very, it's not at all an impolite, it's not at all a polite way that they use in talking to Jesus. They just
you know, burst out, let it fly. What don't you have? Don't you have any idea what's going? Doesn't it mean anything to you if we all go down here? Whereas in Luke, it's put much more politely. Master, Master, we are perishing. Well, we are perishing. You can have that crying out too. But in Luke, in Mark, there is that vivid directness of these terrified disciples who just let you know, give Jesus a blast to wake him up, get him into action. What's the use of him? There he is, sleeping on his cushion, and there everything's falling apart. They're going to go down. Don't you care if we perish? And he awoke and rebuked the wind. And Mark and Luke says, and the raging waves. In Mark it says, and said to the sea. And Luke doesn't have Jesus talking to the sea so much. And doesn't have any words from Jesus at all talking to the sea. But in Mark it says, peace, be still. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. Great contrast there between the storm and the calm at the end. Jesus sort of gets up, rubs his eyes, and comes into action and rebukes the wind and says, peace, be still. Any other points of contrast between these two accounts? In the Mark account, where are you located as you read the story? No, I mean physically located. Are you in the boat, or are you in a helicopter, or are you on the shore? Yeah, you're in the boat, aren't you? When you have waves coming into the boat, you are placed by the one who is narrating it in the boat there with the waves coming upon you. That's characteristically Markan, that you're in the boat too. And the waves come in, that you are there kind of way that Mark tells the story with that vivid immediacy. The teacher and master thing, again, Luke's master is a more civilized and sort of polite way of addressing Jesus. And in Mark, there is... they just call him teacher, which is a plain, everyday term for that they use talking to Jesus, just teacher. There's not much respect in the way the disciples talk to Jesus in Mark. They just call him teacher, you know, give him a great shove, and then really accusingly they get at him. Don't you care at all if we perish? It is characteristic of Luke that it really isn't proper for disciples to be sort of so brusque and direct and rude in their address to Jesus. And in Luke, things are not quite so excited and not... It's more polite, it's a calmer and more reflective way. It is the mark of an educated man that he doesn't get excited all that quickly. The ancient virtue of equanimity. We heard about magnanimity last night. Equanimity is a part of Luke's own education or of the person to whom he's writing. That you keep a reasonably equal mind. You aren't sort of flying up there or thumping down there, but you have learned to carry a fairly steady course. That is the ideal of the educated man, the cultured man, the gentleman in those days.
Well, Luke is a doctor and he's probably had other emergencies.
Yeah. But you, a doctor that then gets all excited isn't much use.
Well, that's good. I mean,
yeah. Yes, yes. He has to do it cool. Right. You have to correct us if we project too many stereotypes wrongly here, Jim. Anything else from these two accounts? And in Mark, they really hit him with the opportunity. Now, anything else, Mark, Luke? Let's turn to Matthew then. Now, you were following Luke last time. Would you follow Mark now while I read Matthew? You in Mark are Mark 4:35, and I shall be, and your finger shall be, Matthew 8:18. Now, when Jesus saw great crowds around him, he gave orders to go over to the other side. And when he got into the boat, his disciples followed him. And behold, there arose a great storm on the sea, so that the boat was being swamped. The waves are going over it. They obliterate the boat. You know, you're watching a boat sometimes, and then it goes down into a trough, and then it comes up on the wave, and you see it again. That's the picture here. Swamped by the waves. But he was asleep. And they went and woke him, saying, "Save, Lord, we are perishing." And he said to them, "Why are you afraid, O men of little faith?" Then he rose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. Now, what do we have from Matthew?
Much more detail.
What detail particularly?
Dialogue.
Good. Good. Yes, 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 that's it. That's it. People can be such a bother.
Yeah.
Let's look at the context. We are in Matthew 8:23, and prior to that, we have, you're right to the end of chapter 7, you have the Sermon on the Mount, a great deal of teaching, and then you get action. You know, in Matthew, things are gathered together into chunks of teaching and chunks of action. And there are five great chunks of teaching. Now, that's another story. We need to ask about that number, even if we don't ask about the threeness of your fingers that you are using, but that we mayn't go after now. We've had teaching, now we have action. And in chapter 8, that's headed in my Bible here, miracles of Jesus. So the crowd is a bit further away, and there isn't much
You have to reach back a long way in Matthew to get the crowd. So it comes more sort of not following on as far as location is concerned terribly closely, but we need to look at what was Jesus talking about just before this.
I don't know whether this is authorized. I picked it up here, but this whole he's talking about following him and the whole business about foxes have holes and birds and he doesn't have a place to lay his head and then he goes and sleep, falls asleep in the boat. I don't know. Is this it's kind of humorous? You know? I don't know whether it's intended that way, but then maybe all these people that followed him in the other boats are the people who picked up on the sermon that said, you know, you better follow me. So then he flips into the boat and all these people will follow after him. Somebody says he had somebody to bury, so he wasn't going to follow him. Is that in the vines?
Yeah, the following is in them all. The following is in them all. And when who gets into the boat first in Matthew? And what does he tell them to do?
Follow.
Right. And in the previous, immediately prior to this section, there's been a whole lot about following Jesus.
So he got him into the storm.
It's almost like it's set up.
Yeah.
Right. What does it mean to be following Jesus? That's the question. We have just had a couple of people who wanted to do it, right? Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus says, foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, the Son of Man has no way to lay his head. Another of the disciples said to him, disciples, who are these disciples? Is he a disciple? Said to him, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. But Jesus said to him, follow me and leave the dead to bury their dead. Do these people then actually follow Jesus or don't they? We have two questions, two discipleship encounters here with Jesus. Well, do they follow him or don't they? Where does it say that?
In the book.
Right.
But maybe there were too many and had to be another book.
Now you're getting that from Mark. You can't use your Mark and boats in Matthew. But those who get in the boats are the ones those who get in the boat, they are followers. That's for sure. They sure did. Now these two other ones, earlier on, we don't know about them. Did they? Didn't they? Well, if they got in the boat, they followed him into the boat, then they did. And there is that, let's notice that open question with regard to these two, just prior to the stilling of the talk. Did they? Didn't they? That question, you see, is left open. It is left with you facing it. But those did who followed. And in the Gospel according to Matthew, follow is the great verb of discipleship. Those who follow Jesus. A follower of Jesus, so much where he goes, they follow. And in order to make that clear, Jesus gets into the boat first, doesn't he? in Mark, they bring Jesus into the boat. The departing action in Mark is with the disciples. In Matthew, it is quite clearly Jesus who moves into the boat and bids them come in with him. There is the call to discipleship in follow me. And they come to follow him because he calls them to follow. It is his word of call which brings them into discipleship. Anything else? Where are you in the Matthean account? Are you watching it going on and wondering about it? Or are you in the boat? Pardon? Yes, but if it's still an open question, then we haven't done it yet. We, yes, right. And so you've the clue. I always try to give you clues in advance of the question, and the clue before was the picture of the boat going down into the trough and then coming up, which isn't so clearly conveyed in this word swamped. You could still sort of be in the boat and be swamped. But it means that the boat is hidden from sight. So that you are not in the boat in Matthew, but you see it disappear. It's gone. And it bobs up again on the next crest of the wave. And it goes down again. Are they going to perish? Well, they're not going to perish. And you are there wondering, would I like to be in that boat or not? And that's your point, you see, where you are left wondering, do I want to be in that boat or not? And there's another point of sort of outside the boat reference, and that's right at the end of the Matthean account. And that's verse 27 in Matthew. It says, and the men marveled, saying, what sort of man is this, that even winds and sea obey him? Who does that wondering in Mark and in Luke? The disciples, right. So they're all in the boat. But the men is just a general term of uncharacterized reference. And it's anthropoi, the generic men, so that it means just people. And as Matthew uses the term people, they are non-disciples. Question?
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems to me that this is rather early on for them to be if they're both being swamped, and they haven't been with him terribly long, it seems it's interesting that they come to him and say, save us, Lord, or we perish, instead of saying, get up and man the ropes, or whatever. And then after they've done that, and he does save them, then they marvel. It's like, for some unknown reason, they run to him and say the word that seems to be a surprise. Save us when they don't even know, when they don't have as much experience with miracles yet. that they might anticipate that from him.
Now remember that you said that about miracles. Just remember that you did, because we shall come back to that. But you have laid your finger on a very important point. In Mark and Luke, what do they ask Jesus for? Get us out of this peril. Right. We're drowned. We're just going to drown. Don't let us drown. Well, yeah, that's right. They are at their wit's end. They've used all of their... That's right. Any port in a storm, we've tried everything else, we may as well try Jesus. And
it seems like in the other stories, they're saying, get up and pull your weight. In this one, they're saying to him, you're the solution to the problem.
In Mark and Luke, they're asking just to be rescued from drowning. In Matthew, they ask him to save them. Save is this great big word of what God does for you and for his people. So being saved isn't just coming out of a storm that looks as though it's going to put your boat under. But to be saved is to get the lot, the whole thing that God does for his people. And how is that further indicated?
They call him Lord.
In Mark, it's an utterly secular term, teacher. And in Luke, it's a bit more respectful, sort of master. But Lord is a term of divine dimension. This is the Kyrios word, which could be used secularly as a term of respect. But when you have the word Lord following the verb save, saving is something that only God can do. And so the word Lord here is sort of full size, divine dimension, Lord. This word Kyrios is the Greek word that was used to translate the Old Testament name of God, Kyrios. When in the Old Testament you get the word Lord in English, the word in Greek was Kyrios, and the word in the Hebrew was Yahweh, or one of those words which was used interchangeably with the name of God. So they respond to Jesus with that dimension. Save, Lord, we are perishing. It's all up with us. And if there's anything going to be brought out of this, you're the only one to do it. And you are the one whom we call to as Lord. And we ask you to save us. We are perishing. And then this very important point that Betty brought up. In Matthew, he speaks to them first, and then he takes care of the winds and the waves. We'll need to ponder that a good deal. And they went and woke him, saying, Save, Lord, we are perishing. We're in Matthew now, 8:26. And he said to them, When your boat is sinking, you don't want to be having a chat or instruction about something or other. But Jesus does not give his attention to the storm, first of all. He talks to them. And what does he talk to them about? Faith.
favorite word in Matthew is this little faith. He speaks to them about their faith. Faith is that which receives Jesus for who he is. Are you treating me for who I really am? And if you are, why are you in such a dither and in such anxiety? He speaks to them to awaken, to sort of bring resurgent the faith that looks to him for all that he is. And in doing that, he has the previous reference of their prayer, which isn't just sort of a scream of fear or a desperate cry, but is a prayer. In Matthew, it is a prayer that is put to Jesus, for it's only God that you can ask to save you. And that's the first question. That's number one item when Jesus. And from what position does Jesus say it to them in Matthew? Pardon? He's still lying down. Still lying down. He first deals from a recumbent position. You know, your cushion's in Mark. But the same sort of meaning as operate is not so clearly stated. But Jesus is still lying down. Anybody that's lying down is perfectly powerless and useless. You can't do a blessed thing for anybody's good or to rescue them when you're lying in the boat. And so he goes on lying there and talks to them about their faith. Okay? You got that then. You get the faith question first. And when he's dealt with that, well then, he deals with the other business. The matter, then he arose in verse 20. Then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. Now there are two more items in here that you can't get from the English, and that is in the word rebuked. That is a word which is used sort of beating back, putting to flight, conquering, destroying, overthrowing all that is set against God and his people, all that would destroy them. That is what is the object of this verb, which is translated rebuked. In the Gospels, it is the devils who are rebuked. Here, it is the winds and the waves that are rebuked. And what is happening to the winds and waves when they are rebuked as the forces of evil are rebuked? Then it's not just a lot of H2O roaring about and swamping your boats. There is another dimension, a threat of destruction far greater than merely drowning. And the other Greek word that is used in Matthew, the Greek word that is used in Matthew alone, is the word that is used for the storm. In Matthew, the word used is seismos, from which we get seismograph, which is earthquake. And that is a word which in Scripture is used of when everything is shaken and everything falls apart and comes, it seems, to ruin. It is a word which is used as a description of the end time. That the time when nothing holds, everything shakes and collapses, disintegrates, there's nothing to hang on to anymore. That's the seismos of the end time. That is the word that is used here in Matthew of the storm. So what is Matthew doing with the storm when he calls it a seismos and when it is rebuked with the verb that is used for the demonic forces or all that would threaten to destroy God's people and his work? Then it's not just plain water that it's going to drown you in a minute. It's that which is going to wipe you out completely. And when you get water no longer being just that kind of water, that is what we call allegorizing. Where the storm and the wind are given a dimension beyond the meteorological, but they express all that threatens to destroy us when we're in the boat with Jesus. And you who have heard lots of sermons on this passage, what happens to the boat then? The boat gets allegorized, right? What's the boat become? There we see are moving into another way of interpreting scripture. There's none of that in Mark and Luke. What has the ship become the picture of? Every time you go into church, you go into the nave, right? Where Christ's people gather and where he steers the show. The part of the ship, the part of the church where you sit is called the nave, which is Latin, from the Latin navis, ship. Navigate and all of that. So when you say go to church, you say let's go and get in the boat. And Matthew starts us off thinking that way. You see a dimension in that Matthean account, which then isn't there in Mark and in Luke. Any comment or question? The great big question which remains still before us is Betty's observation, how Jesus first speaks to them and then takes care of the storm. Whereas in Mark and in Luke, he takes care of the storm, and then he speaks to them. What is Matthew teaching us by telling it that way?
Good. That's rather interesting, isn't it? Just by his character, I mean, you know, I've seen just stretching the point.
It is characteristic of Matthew's account that he always, Matthew is a very teaching kind of gospel, and he wants to make sure that you get the point. Mark regards you as more intelligent and hopes that you will get it without that extra amount of help that the Mark, that Matthew always gives you. There's something a bit schoolmasterish about Matthew. He'll sort of, he'll explicate it for you to make sure that you get it. Whereas Mark brings you right up to the point where the only way that you can come to terms with what you've just heard is to get it right. But he doesn't do it for you. And so clearly in Mark, it is always the question of Jesus. What does this passage tell us about Jesus? You may, whenever you read anything in the Gospels, when you come to the end of the section, you must always ask, what's the Jesus point? And until you've got that, you haven't understood what it's been going on about. In Matthew, you have the same sort of thing, but he tends to explicate to make sure that you get it. And you've got that increment of sort of teaching and instruction in the Matthean account that you don't have in Matthew and Luke. Matthew helps you to get hold of what really was all going on there. And he leaves you with the question of discipleship. The comment in Matthew at the end is made by unbelievers, the men, hoianthropoi, you know, people. Tom, Dick, and Harry, they just gasp at it. And so they haven't got the point. And of course there's a value in having unbelieving Tom, Dick, and Harry marvel at it, because then you have independent witnesses of the miracle. It's not just disciples who cooked up a miracle or misunderstood something that Jesus said or done. If the unbelievers marvel at what's happened, then you can trust the unbeliever that it really was a miracle. That's in Matthew 2. But since that is an unbelieving word, it is not yet a believing word. And what is the believing response to this stilling of the storm? What is it that is faith? How does getting Jesus for all that he is in this event come to expression? What does then faith say about it? An unbeliever can marvel at the miracle. And that ties in also with the question why in Matthew you have the word of Christ evoking faith and then the business of the miracle. Let us come to that question sort of first tomorrow. And you have this discussion in Tilikhi chapter 3, and we should then tomorrow also get on into chapter 1.